Hi, everybody. Today's Friday, June 6, 2025, and our friend Larry Johnson is back with us. Welcome back, Larry.
I'm glad to be here.
Larry, let's get started with the outcome of the Ukrainian attack on Russia. Mm-hmm. And the way that many people are arguing in the middle, in the United States, that there's so much concern about what has happened. And here is what General Blaine Holt said about what has happened in Russia and how he perceives that. He, considering that he is supporting Donald Trump and his administration, here is what he said.
Concerned about global or national security in my life than I am right now. And yes, I understand it's a tactical win. The Ukrainians have a tactical win. But they hit a third of a strategic bomber force that is covered by a START treaty that goes back to 2010. There is no Russian in the military there that believes that Ukraine was able to achieve this without Western intelligence help, including our country. Mm. General Konikayev, the leader of rocket forces for Russia, has now openly said they are now locking in the coordinates for Paris, London, and Washington, D.C. This is an escalation path now without a reverse gear. I pray there's a reverse gear that President Trump can find by calling President Putin. But as a military officer with 27 years of service at the flag level and NATO service, I can tell you we are in a big dangerous place that we weren't in 3 days ago. And I pray that something good happens in those talks today.
Larry, here is what the Russian ambassador to the United Kingdom said, just to have the two pictures together to understand the gravity.
That they are bringing conflict to a different level of escalation.
Which would mean what?
Which would mean better not to, and better to realize and to remember what we are doing. We have a limited conflict right now, which of course has a wider projection on the European security. But limited conflict should stay a limited conflict, and not to escalate it, not to try to engulf World War III. That's the worst case scenario that we can imagine.
Yeah, go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, so you know, boy, this incident has really created quite a wide variety of opinions and reactions. I watched your exchange with John Helmer and Ray McGovern the other night. let's start with the Ukrainians grossly exaggerated the effect of their attack. While it was, let's call it, brilliant, operationally brilliant, being able to infiltrate these trucks in to Russia and then at some depth, and then be able to launch those drones ostensibly against these targets with the intent of attacking and destroying, as the general said, a third of Russia's strategic bomber capability. Audacious, but that didn't happen. Apparently, the drone attacks at three of the airports failed, completely failed. Whether it was electronic warfare, air defense system, operational failure on the Ukrainian, but I don't know. But they failed. The other two airports that were hit, it turned out, only destroyed about 5 to 7 aircraft. It's not entirely clear. But what is clear is that some of those aircraft were actually decommissioned. They were not, active in the strategic doctrine of Russia. That said, this was still, despite it not being consequential in terms of physical damage, it was extremely damaging psychologically for the Russians, that this, they reacted to this with great anger. Now, Ray and I have had a We've got a difference of opinion on this, and I always value Ray's opinions and judgment. But, you know, Ray was arguing that this is the reaction is the Russians is to the quote terrorism that took place on Friday and Saturday, the attack on the two bridges, the attack in Kursk, which didn't kill anybody to my knowledge, but destroyed a bridge, and then the attack in Bryansk, where the bridge was down so that it would collide with an oncoming passenger train and killed at least seven people, wounded maybe up to upwards of 100 people. Well, yeah, those are terrorist attacks. There's and the Russians are rightly outraged about it. But I forget, these are not the first terrorist attacks over the course of this last 3 years. You know, you had the attack on the Kerch Bridge in October 2022. I forget how many, you know, it killed one or two people, but it blew a hole in the bridge and they had to close the bridge down and repair it. That was significant. And then March 2024, the attack on Crocus City Hall. My God, they killed over 135 people and wounded over 341. That was enormous. I mean, you know, that's on a completely different scale compared to what happened in Bryansk, dropping a bridge on a train. And yet Russia's reaction to that has been far, you know, it's now saying that we're moving into, this is no longer a special military operation. This is a counterterrorism operation. And that is not just a word chosen because it's a convenient or it sounds cool. This goes back to how Russia carried out the war in Chechnya from 1999 through 2009, 2010, the Second Chechen War. The counterterrorism operation means an escalation in the violence by the Russian military. It means certain targets that previously were considered off limits or to be avoided are now on the table. And I think that includes Vladimir Zelensky, who can be now targeted and taken out. We're going to see, Russia suffered assassinations at the hands of Ukrainian terrorist plots, you know, at least two, if not three generals. So you got to ask, why is Russia reacting now so strongly to this? And this is where Ray and I, you know, respectfully disagree with each other. Ray thinks that it's the terror that Russia's ignoring the attack on the strategic component. And I think this colonel, American colonel, was correct in recognizing the gravity of it, that although Ukraine did not succeed in inflicting the kind of damage that they claimed, nonetheless, they demonstrated a willingness to hit those targets without regard to the consequences. And the outrage Putin and company, I think Ray's position is, well, Putin, if this is such a big deal, Putin and company would have said something about it. The fact that they're not specifically commenting on it, I think there's another explanation. They're embarrassed as hell. And why rub their face in it? They're going to take corrective action. And it's not going to be, there was missile strikes and drone strikes over the last 24 hours. That's not the retaliation. The retaliation that's coming is going to be quite severe. And we know that thanks to Donald Trump. Because we've seen what a difference of more than a week makes with Trump and Putin. You know, on May 26th, you know, Trump was derisive of Putin. You know, he's crazy. You know, remember that? And he said, I don't know why he's doing what he's doing. Well, they had a conversation on Wednesday of this week. Now Trump's singing a different tune. Yeah, President Putin, didn't call him Putin, called him President Putin, strongly emphasized that he's going to have to respond to this. And, okay, you know, Trump didn't say, I told him, hell no, you're not going to do that. Trump didn't say any of that. And you got to then look at what the U.S. State Department did within hours of the end of that conversation. They came out with a physical warning to Americans in Ukraine, basically, get the hell out, take cover. Something bad's going to happen. So, you know, this attack on these, the attack on two of the airfields, the attempted attack on three of the others, has marked a shift. And we'll call it a watershed moment in this war between Ukraine and Russia. And it's going up. It's now escalating.
Larry, you've mentioned the phone call between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. Donald Trump said that he didn't know about what was going on with the case of Ukrainian attack. But how, what kind of argument is that? Is that going to put him in a better position, in your opinion?
Oh, no. Let's call him Butterfly McQueen. Do you know who Butterfly McQueen is? Butterfly McQueen was this black, she was a path-breaking black actress in Hollywood. And she appeared in the movie Gone with the Wind. And in that movie, her most iconic, memorable line was, oh, Miss Scarlett, I don't know nothing about birthing no babies. You know, she had pretended to be a midwife and then admitted, I don't know anything about birthing babies. That's Donald Trump. Attack on Russia? I don't know nothing. Or we call him Sergeant Schultz. You know, we come up with all sorts of television characters. You remember Sergeant Schultz from Hogan's Hero? I know nothing. I see nothing. I hear nothing. You know, please, Trump. What you're admitting is you're completely out of the loop. I think it highly, highly unlikely that Ukraine planned this for 18 months. I mean, this is a story we're being given and people are repeating it. You know, I think it's nonsense. But they planned it for 18 months and didn't leak a word to the CIA, their buddies, who they've been planning other operations with. Yeah, that makes sense. More likely is there are CIA officers who know about it, and maybe they had received guidance. Don't get directly involved, but you know, keep us up to date on what they're doing. So the CIA knew, which means at least Trump would have had it in a briefing, special access program briefing. Did the CIA actually involve, was it involved with the planning and execution? That's possible. I can't rule that out. But what's interesting is to look at the sequence of events that started on Sunday in the aftermath of the attacks on those airfields. Lavrov calls Marco Rubio. Now, I had heard, I haven't been able to get a confirmation of this, that Marco Rubio got called at 8 p.m. at night, East Coast time. Well, that's 3 a.m. in the morning, Russia time. Lavrov, he's older than I am, so he's an old man. You got to be in bed at that time. So, you know, some suggest that, oh, it was just a normal phone call. He just wanted to call up Marco and say, hey, how about those talks, peace talks we're having tomorrow? Maybe we can, you know, have a great outcome. You know, no. Lavrov was calling Rubio because basically Putin wanted to know, what did the damn Americans know about this and what are they saying? And let them know that we're going to hold anybody that was even peripherally involved with this responsible. And the responsible means, well, we're going, there'll be targets of counterattacks. So they had a conversation at what was an ungodly hour from Lavrov. And then Rubio apparently got off the phone and called Donald Trump like, Mr. President, we got a problem. And notice what happened then on Monday and Tuesday with Trump's social media. It was quiet. Keeping Trump off of social, are you kidding me? Man, he's like a crack addict learning to get a fix when it comes to social media. And I maintain that what they're trying to figure out, how the hell do we defuse this? How do we keep this from escalating? And at the same time, they're trying to figure that out. The Russians showed up in Istanbul for the talks with Ukraine, but it wasn't talks. Medinsky, the lead negotiator, spent two hours, 15 minutes before that meeting with Umarov, who was the ostensible head of that Ukrainian delegation. And it was not, I would say, a pleasant meeting, at least for Ukraine. And Medinsky was letting him know in no uncertain terms what the approach was going to be going forward. And that they take this deal or, you know, something worse is coming. Umarov scoots off to Washington to brief the Trump team. And he's not carrying good news in that. Then on Tuesday, again, remember, Trump is like sort of mute, silent with respect to social media, not saying a word about any of the attacks. No apologies yet, nothing. Pete Hegseth comes out and announces, yeah, that Ukrainian, you know, contact group that we've had, that we meet like every month, I'm not attending, and I'm not only not going to show up in person, I'm not even going to attend from Zoom. I'm sending Matt Whitaker. So this marks the first time Secretary of Defense, whether it was Austin or Hegseth, has not attended that meeting. Do you think that was just a coincidence? I maintain it was one of Trump's ways of signaling to Russia, okay, we're backing away from this Ukraine project. We recognize that this is too dangerous. And then came the phone call on Wednesday. I don't know who initiated it. I suspect it was Trump, but, you know, we'll see. But in any event, Putin, if you watch Putin's speech that day, and I don't know if the phone call with Trump took place before or after that speech, Putin was angry. He was very stern. His body language was such that he was, let's call it, aggressive. And they... you know, he even in that speech, or it was a discussion with his national security team, but they televised it live for all of Russia. I don't even know if there's any sense in continuing these talks with these terrorists. So they, you know, they moved it into that new realm as a counterterrorism operation. So when you put all that together, the Russians put the United States on notice. And they're going to retaliate, and there's going to be a significant retaliation. So significant that Trump felt compelled to tell Marco Rubio, "Tell him, get your people out of there. Something bad's coming."
Larry, Putin said that the main reason of this attack was to somehow sabotage the talks between Ukrainians and Russians, or maybe trying to convince Russians that there is nothing coming out of the talks. Let's not go to Istanbul to talk with Ukrainian, which I would assume that would be the best outcome of what has happened for the British government. They're doing everything to get something like that from the talks, because in my opinion, they're not happy with what is happening right now in terms of the direct talks between Russians and Ukrainians. And with the talk that, with what the Russian ambassador said to the British media, he said that this escalation is so dangerous. I assume that the objective of this sort of argument on his part is the British government, is not the United States specifically. How do you see the way that the British government is trying to manipulate everything? We had Starmer coming out that we have been threatened by Russia. We have to build up our military while nobody's threatening the United Kingdom. I haven't seen anything in the media pointing at that direction. How can we understand this sort of activity, this sort of complications, this sort of communication interactions that are happening right now between Russia and the United Kingdom?
Well, actually, I think Russia is, I understand Russia is pressuring the Brits to shutter their embassy in Moscow. They'll break off diplomatic relations. You know, I think it's important to understand Russia's approach to these so-called negotiations with Ukraine. I think it is wrong to believe that Russia thinks there is a way to achieve a peaceful negotiated settlement with Ukraine. Russia absolutely does not believe that. Putin doesn't believe that. But they need, from the standpoint of dealing with the global South and the other BRICS members, Russia needs to be perceived as trying to obtain a negotiated settlement. That way, these other countries feel under less pressure from the West to, you know, push Russia. This terrorist attack, as Russia is portraying it, has now given Russia an out, because they've been negotiating in good faith, and look what it got them. It got them a terrorist attack, an attack on Russia's strategic bombers, which is also part of that terrorist attack. That's how Russia's defining it. Even though I would argue that that's a military attack, but still Russia's perceiving that and lumping that as a terrorist attack. The talks and what Russia delivered to the Ukrainian delegation, a memorandum, was basically a document of surrender. And, you know, Ukraine's rejected it. And, you know, in fact, Zelensky even said he doesn't see any value in any more meetings. So, you know, Russia has achieved what it wanted to achieve of making Ukraine the culprit for the breakdown of negotiations. Within that, then this gets back to the question of Great Britain. Great Britain remains the biggest bad actor in this entire drama. And yet, you know, I don't see Russia wanting to do much to him, because, you know, it's like having a mosquito buzzing around your head. Annoying, but not a deadly threat, just annoying. And that's what the Brits are. They're absolutely annoying, but they're impotent.
Larry, do you feel that they're somehow capable of manipulating Germany with the new chancellor? Do you see any sort of leverage on their part in Germany right now?
Yeah, between what, the UK?
The United Kingdom and Germany.
No.
Right now, they're sending, right after the call between the two presidents, Merz is in the United States talking with, anytime that Vladimir Putin is talking with Donald Trump, they're trying to do something. Europeans are trying to do something to maybe talk with Vladimir Putin on phone, and or maybe a new visit from the Europeans. They're somehow, I don't know, they're trying to manage Donald Trump in the direction that they want Donald Trump to be.
Yeah, manage Donald Trump? Are you crazy? You know, he's uncontrollable. I mean, look at his girl fight with Elon Musk yesterday. You're ugly. You're stupid. You know, oh my God. You know, a billionaire bitch club. Okay, it was just so nobody controls Trump. Trump, you know, he decides sort of what he's going to do, and he does it. Whether he actually consults with people and gets good advice, usually not. You know, he's shown that over and over and over. He's, you know, he's trying to salvage, you know, maintain a relationship with Putin. But I gotta believe that the Russians don't see Trump as a reliable negotiating partner. I think they see him as unreliable and volatile and, you know, somewhat unpredictable. So they got to figure out how to try to manage that. And that gets into managing expectations as well.
Yeah, you mean managing the situation, not Donald Trump, because he's...
Well, you know, they know that Trump is susceptible to flattery. So yeah. They do that. They go out of their way not to overtly disrespect him. Well, they may be laughing about him behind their backs, behind his back. They make sure that they do everything in a respectful manner, knowing that with his fragile narcissistic ego, he could, you know, he would take umbrage and, you know, start punching back just like he did with Elon, you know. You know, completely unnecessary, but that's been Trump's, you know, that's been his hallmark, particularly as he gets older. You know, he becomes more brittle that way.
Here is what Larry Donald Trump said during the meeting that he had with Merz about Russia and Ukraine.
He got hit. He's been doing hitting, so I understand it. But he got hit hard. And I don't think he's playing games. I think I've always said he wanted the whole thing. I thought he wanted the entire everything having to do with Ukraine.
What sort of argument is that he wants all of Ukraine? I don't know if he somehow is playing a game, because... if we assume that he's playing a game that says Russia wanted all of Ukraine, I saved Ukraine from that, and let's go and find some sort of solution. Yeah. Other than that, I don't find any sort of reason behind
it. Yeah, no, it's Trump's just making that up. From the outset, Putin's goal was not to take all of Ukraine at all. And that's been a Western lie fed into the system to, you know, try to, you know, rally public support in the West against Putin. You know, what is concerning is when Trump says things like that, it just reflects a fundamental ignorance about what's going on between Russia and Ukraine. Because in Trump's world, as he said yesterday, this is like two kids fighting. Well, you got to let them fight it out. Well, I think there's another more apt metaphor. The Ukrainians and Russians are in a burning building, and Donald Trump is out standing outside as the arsonist who helped set the building on fire. He's responsible. Biden's responsible. Obama's responsible. George W. Bush is responsible. This has been a project underway since Bill Clinton was president, to go to war with Russia, destroy Russia, and take control of its assets. And Donald Trump is certainly proud of the fact that he gave javelins to Ukraine. So he hasn't been about peace. He's been aiding and abetting this whole disaster. And, you know, he's in the unique position that he can put an end to it today. But he hasn't done that.
Not only javelins. Here is what he said about Nord Stream.
Russia, are you willing to put more pressure? pressure on Putin to end the war by imposing new sanctions on Russia and also on China.
Well, remember, I'm the one that ended Nord Stream 2. Going to a place called Germany, come to think of it. I'm sorry I did that. I ended Nord Stream 2. Nobody else did. And then when Biden came in, he immediately approved it. That's the largest, essentially the largest pipeline in the world, going to Germany and other countries. And by the way, we have so much oil and gas, you will not be able to buy it all. I mean, you literally, we have so much, and I hope we're going to make that a part of our trade deal, because we have more than anybody else. We have actually the most by far in the world, probably double what anyone else has. So we'll work on that. I'm sure that's something we'll discuss today.
Mr. President.
Yeah, he's taking responsibility for the sabotage of Nord Stream pipeline. It's so somehow amazing that he tries to play both sides, that he says to Vladimir Putin, I'm with you, I want to put an end to the conflict. On the other hand, he somehow shows Europeans how aggressive, how radical he is toward Russia, has been toward Russia, and while he denies his role in what's going on in Ukraine.
Yeah, it is. Trump's in just a delusional state. He tried to hold up the Nord Stream pipeline, but the Nord Stream pipeline was ready to go into operation. So it was completed despite Trump's attempts to interfere. And it was under Biden that it was destroyed. And it was at Biden's orders to the CIA that it was destroyed. But again, this is Trump. He takes, again, he's so insecure. And, this is what's sort of crazy about people like Trump. They're extremely wealthy. He's been very successful in his world of real estate development. And as a television entertainer. So he's had some real accomplishments. But, he got to keep telling you how great he is, because, he's not secure in himself. And, when you have somebody and the narcissism, the insecurity, boy, that's a dangerous mix. And, what he should have been talking about was, it is unfortunate that with the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline, that Germany was deprived of cheap natural gas so it could fund, keep its industries intact and be in a position to actually produce weapons that we need in NATO. I mean, if he's thinking about this sensibly, but he's not. It's all about, look what I've done. And he takes credit for things that he didn't do.
I think that's a key issue when it comes to Russia, China, and Iran. But they're not going to say, Donald Trump, you are big and beautiful.
He's not
going to get some sort of compliment on from these countries. That's why he's going to get a lot from Europeans. And how, Larry, with the case of Germany, do you think that Donald Trump, with this visit of the German chancellor, does he really believe that they can provide energy to Germany at the level and with the price being reasonable for Germany?
No, man. Germany's going to take it up the backside. United States, we're happy to supply natural gas, but it's going to come at a price. I mean, there's no way it can be cheaper than the Nord Stream, simply because it's going to be loaded on ships and carted across the ocean. With the Nord Stream pipeline, it came straight in, and the Russians were able to offer a much better price. You get to watch the Germans wallow in their own mess. They helped create this. They didn't stand up for themselves. They didn't protest it. They didn't accuse the United States of an act of war. You've destroyed one of our natural resources. And the fact and the reality is it's hurting German people. But, you know, Trump doesn't care.
Yeah. And when it comes, Larry, because one part of this situation with the energy in Europe and specifically in Germany is what's going on. One aspect would be what's going on with the 500% secondary sanctions on Russia that they're talking right now in the United States about. They want to put it on China, India, and eventually on mm-hmm. Europe. Do you think that Merz was talking about this with Donald Trump? Is he concerned about it?
I don't think so. But I don't know if that came up. I don't see why, if anything, you know, Merz, he did talk to members of Congress. And in that conjunction, you know, that may have come up. And I suspect he would have been very enthusiastic about it, wanting to impose greater sanctions necessarily on Russia, except that what Lindsey Graham is proposing is basically sanctions on China and India that will hurt them and hurt the United States. It's just, you know, none of this is being thought through.
Here is what Donald Trump said in terms of sanctions.
Mr. President, so would you consider to put more sanctions on Russia? Because this discussion is going on now for weeks and months, and you tweeted about it once, but then nothing happened. So
yeah, when I see the moment when we're not going to make a deal, when this thing won't stop, at that moment, yeah, it's in my brain, the deadline. when I see the moment where it's not going to stop, and I'm sure you're going to do the same thing, will be very, very, very tough. And it could be on both countries, to be honest. You know, it takes two to tango. But we're going to be very tough, whether it's Russia or anybody else. We're going to be very tough.
The deadline is in his brain. I don't know if he has it.
Yeah, nobody's home in that brain. That's the problem. You know, this is another idle threat by Trump. Russia would like to have normal relations with the United States. And despite the history of the last 30 years, where the United States, through NATO, has been basically constantly at war with Russia. And instead of the United States, you know, stopping the attacks, we've continued to attack and attack and attack and attack and facilitate efforts to destroy Russia. You know, at some point, I've described it before with you, it's like being in an abusive relationship with somebody. And there comes a moment where you just got to walk away and say, I'm not having contact with this person anymore. I'm not dealing with them. You just walk away. That's what I think Russia ultimately needs to do. Just, you know, tell the United States, have a nice day. You go about your own way, and we're going to go about ours. But, you know, Trump, this is more Trump bombast, because the fact of the matter is that there's nothing the United States can do to Russia that's going to alter Russia's courses of action right now.
Now, do you feel that if Donald Trump doesn't get a Ukrainian settlement in a long run, that would cause some sort of problem between NATO and Russia? Because considering the behavior on the part of European leaders, it's somehow, if they do something radical as they did with the Russian nuclear bombers, and they did something with the Kursk region, we were somehow surprised. And right now, nuclear bombers is something, the limits, this red line is moving toward Russia. And Russia, it comes to a moment, as it happened with the conflict in Ukraine, says enough is enough. Let's go and attack them. Let's teach them a lesson. Do you feel that we're going to get into that moment, or if we don't get anything in as a somehow a Ukrainian settlement, considering negotiations?
Well, if rhetoric, if words equated into action, then yes, there'd be a war between Russia and England, Germany, and France in a heartbeat, no doubt about it. But fortunately, the reality intrudes, and the fact is that none of these countries have the military strength, either in manpower or in weapons, that they could even last a week going up against Russia. And then there's the issue that Russia's not going to invade them, so they would have to somehow go to Russia. Good luck with that. Just ask Napoleon how that turned out. I don't know what it's going to take to bring an end to this kind of rhetorical excess on the part of Starmer and Macron and Merz. But at some point, Russia is going to deal a death blow to Ukraine. And at that point, these countries will be faced with, do we jump into this war or do we walk away? And if they jump into it, it'll be at their peril of their own destruction.
I think as these terrorist acts on the part of Ukraine are increasing, the doubt on the situation of Odessa in the future is much more, they're much more visible in the mind of Russians right now. Shall we let Odessa and Nikolaev in their hand? What would that cause in terms of these terrorist acts in the future? Because we know that how much important Odessa is in terms of the attacks in the Kursk region, in terms of how they can attack Russia. Do you feel that Russia is somehow, they're somehow internally discussing the situation with Odessa and Nikolaev going up to Kharkov?
Oh, no. Well, look, I believe one of the messages that was delivered on Monday when Medinsky sat down with Umarov was, this is the last best offer you're going to get, because the next offer means we're taking Odessa, we're taking Nikolaev, and you will no longer have access to the Black Sea. We'll control all access to the Black Sea. You're going to be cut off from the sea. And that was the message that Umarov carried back to Zelensky and carried back to Washington, D.C. So, you know, Russia, look, before this is all over, I don't know whether it'll be this year or into early next year. I frankly don't see how Ukraine can sustain its army, the military effort, without continued support from the United States, which is looks to be drying up. But Russia is going to ultimately take significant portions, if not all, of the territory east of the Dnieper, if for no other reason as a buffer zone. Just keep the Ukrainians behind that wall of water that represents the Dnieper River, keep them on the west side, and Russia will then proceed to rebuild eastern Ukraine.
Larry, those people who are arguing that supporting Ukraine and sending more weapons to Ukraine, as General Jack Keane on Fox News was arguing, and here is what he said. Let me play it for you.
The peace process exhibited by the United States to leverage someone to change their behavior. We've got to do the same thing with Russia. It is part of the process. It's not outside the process. And that means we got to leverage him. And we don't know if that will actually work. Let's be honest about it.
Yeah.
But we do know what is not working. And just the diplomatic talking is not working. So the leverage has got to be, I think, number one, military assistance, and give them the robust air defense systems and the other things they desperately need. Let's leverage Putin just as we did Zelensky. We don't know, let's be frank, if it's going to work, but it certainly is worth a try at this point.
Yeah.
Because diplomatic talks are not getting us there.
Larry, it's somehow amazing that he tries to picture the situation totally the opposite way. We haven't seen any sort of diplomacy, any sort of talks happening between the two parties, meaning the United States and Russia. And while we had the experience with the military operation, with the support to Ukraine, more than 3 years and 3 years and a half, we are in this conflict. Go ahead.
Well, Keane, you know, listening to Keane, his strategy is, let's throw jello at the wall and see what sticks. Well, you know, that's not how military plans are supposed to operate. You know, the military planning process is supposed to come up with courses of action, and with respect to each of those courses of action, identify what resources do we need, what are our chances of a successful outcome, what are the risks, what can we expect the enemy to do in response to if we take this course of action? Yeah, this shows why he was a failed general, number one. We do have negotiations from the standpoint that once Trump and Putin were talking, and then Witkoff could go to Russia and meet with Putin. Yeah, that was that was progress, something that hadn't happened. And just the fact that over this last, on Sunday, that Lavrov felt free to call up Marco Rubio and say, we got a problem with you. And, at least the communication is going back and forth. But, what you're seeing Jack Keane do in that clip, just acknowledge that he's acknowledging the fact that Ukraine is losing the war and that there's no clear path forward for giving Ukraine a chance for victory.
I would wonder where is Steve Witkoff right now and how you mentioned the talks, but we don't see Steve Witkoff anymore.
Yeah, he's sort of fallen out of the limelight for now. I don't know what that means. Maybe he is just... Still quietly meeting with the Israelis and Hamas. I would hope so, but also the talks with Iran are sort of they're on hold right now. So we'll see.
Donald Trump wanted to talk about the Iranian talks with Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. And Putin said he's willing to participate, he's willing to help the process of negotiations. What does Donald Trump want from Vladimir Putin, in your opinion?
Well, I think he'd like to get Putin to persuade the Iranians to give up all nuclear enrichment or uranium enrichment, and Putin's not going to do that. But the language that Trump used was very careful in terms of to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. And Russia... Yeah, we can do that because we know it's already true. We've got a security agreement in place with Iran that we've pledged to work with them on their peaceful nuclear exchange, and we wouldn't do that if they had an active nuke. So, yeah, no, we'll help. Sure, Mr. President, we can help you get the assurances and proof you need that Iran doesn't have it. I hope Trump takes the deal. But I've seen some disturbing signs that Trump's getting ready to launch the military strike against Iran. It may just be, again, posturing for negotiation's sake, or it may be genuine. I don't know.
Larry, do you believe that the way that Donald Trump says no enrichment to Iran, does he really believe that Iran would go in that direction? I don't see that coming. The supreme leader of Iran just said
he's hopeful that Iran would go in that direction. But as you and I both know, Iran's not going in that direction. It's sort of a fool's hope. So Trump is then, he's faced with his promise that he'd bring peace to stop the war between Ukraine and Russia. Well, that's now dead. He's basically conceding the war is going to go on, and there's not a lot he can do about it. He's in a position that he can get this deal with Iran, but it's going to be at a cost to his relationship with the pro-Zionist crowd. Now, I would note, we just got word yesterday, day before yesterday, that three of the most ardent supporters of Israel that were in Trump's National Security Council, this one woman who'd actually been in the IDF herself, that they've been booted out of the NSC. So Trump is like house cleaning, getting rid of some of these uber Zionists. That may be an indicator that, you know, Trump's trying to come to a more sensible position with respect to Iran.
Larry, how's the situation between Hamas and Israel right now? And you mentioned Steve Witkoff maybe talking, trying to cut a deal between the two. But the situation in Gaza is everybody knows what's going on. It's a nightmare and starvation, killing the people. And do you see any sort of future for the talks or what's going on between Hamas and the United States? I'm not considering Israel because I don't see Netanyahu as Zelensky in Ukraine. They hope Zelensky wants some sort of Ukrainian settlement. Everybody knows the outcome of that settlement would be the removal of Zelensky and his administration. The same goes to Netanyahu and his administration.
The key there is, if the United States decides that the peace talks should go forward, they'll go forward, because we're in a position to dictate to Israel. Israel won't like it. You know, I got confirmed yesterday. I can't reveal the source, but that there's still a lot of CIA files that the CIA has not released regarding the assassination of JFK. And the reason is because Israel is so strongly implicated in that assassination. That's why they're covering it up. So, you know, one of these days I could, you know, one way to get for Trump to buy some protection for himself would actually be to release those files and make it clear how destructive Israel has been, how unfriendly it has been, how, you know, murderous it has been in its relationship with the United States. And that would really further isolate it. Because, you know, right now, apart from the United States, there's not another major country that's backing Israel uncritically. Not one.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw the interview with Matt Miller and the way that he right now sees the conflict in Ukraine, in Gaza. Here is what they said, Larry.
Going on in Gaza now is a genocide?
I don't think it's a genocide, but I think I think it is without a doubt true that Israel has committed war crimes.
You wouldn't have said that at the podium.
Yeah, look, because when you're at the podium, you're not expressing your personal opinion. You're expressing the conclusions of the United States government. The United States government had not concluded that they've committed war crimes, still have not concluded that.
But your personal view is they have.
Well,
while you were there.
But let me qualify that. There are two ways to think about the commission of war crimes. One is if the state has pursued a policy to deliberately committing war crimes or is acting reckless in a way that aids and abets war crimes. And that, I think, is an open question. I think what is hard is almost certainly not an open question is that there have been individual incidents that have been war crimes where members of the Israeli military have committed war crimes. So ultimately, in almost every major conflict, including conflicts prosecuted by democracies, you will see individual members of the military of militaries commit war crimes. And the way you judge a democracy is whether they hold those people accountable.
But Israel hasn't. That's
my point, right? Is we have not yet seen them hold sufficient numbers of the military accountable, and I think it's an open question whether they're going to.
I'm really struck that you think
I don't know how can they believe that Netanyahu would go after some sort of investigation in what's going on in Gaza.
Yeah, no, he's not. This is the situation is worsening domestically for Netanyahu. Now that you've had both Ehud Olmert and Ehud Barak, both former prime ministers, come out and say, hey, Israel's engaged in committing war crimes. Now, they're being dismissed as, you know, political opponents of Netanyahu, et cetera. I'm doing this for politics. But the fact of the matter is their voice carries some authority. And even more importantly, you know, you're in trouble when Piers Morgan turns against you after he's been, you know, celebrating everything that Israel had been doing to defeat Hamas.
That's a sign that the mainstream media or maybe the British media is going against Israel, or somehow they're changing their mind because they cannot get whatever they're asking.
Well, again, with Britain, the number of Muslim migrants that now live in that country and are now part of the vote, you know, the voting public is significant. So naturally, they're going to start lining up against. There's a real split in the UK that it's going to sharpen, and it's going to sharpen in a way that those who are pro-Palestinian will overwhelm those who are pro-Israeli.
So far, it wasn't interpreted in a foreign policy of the United Kingdom. I don't know if in the future that would be the case. And Starmer is not in a good position right now. He's just so weak. Even I would argue weaker than Macron in France. And
well, he spent so much time in Ukraine, he should probably consider running for office in Ukraine. He'd probably actually get more support. He'd probably line up more votes for himself in Ukraine because he is now extremely unpopular. And the opposition that's coming from his own party and within his own party is significant. It's not to be discounted.
Larry, before wrapping up, you've mentioned the fight between Elon Musk and Donald Trump. One of the very interesting points that during this fight has happened was the Elon Musk just saying, declaring that we need a third party in the United States. This doesn't work. I think many people want that.
Yeah.
Many people want some sort of solution for what's going on in the United States. Do you feel that if Elon Musk considers that as a real issue for the U.S. policy, for the political system of the United States, the help coming from Elon Musk, which we know that would be crucial and important, could help to create a third party in the United States?
Yeah, he'd have the financial resources to do it. You know, there are already... You know, we've already got third parties, but none of them are really viable or have any kind of broad appeal. The Libertarian Party, there's this new group out called No Labels. But the entrenched bureaucratic interests that the two political parties, dominant political parties, currently serve are destroying America. And frankly, I don't know if it's correctable without massive economic upheaval, and possibly even a war. You know, Russia, you look at the transformation of Russia from what it was under the Soviet Union in 1991 to what it is today. And it is a night and day difference, dramatic transformation. Well, that came about in part because of the utter collapse of the Soviet system in the 1990s. And, you know, the fact that the middle class in Russia almost disappeared in the 1990s, only 7% of the population was classified as middle class. And the life expectancy was declining from 63 to 56. And, you know, to get that kind of, you know, you're a scientist, you know what that kind of decline mathematically signifies in terms of actual human beings, horrendous number. So it's going to take something like that to bring about change in the United States. And it's out of that kind of chaos that you could potentially get a third party. But, right now there's so much pressure to protect the status quo that they actually create barriers for entry for the third parties.
I think the case that you mentioned can be considered about China as well. Look at what China is today and compare it to 20 years ago, 10 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And it's, on the other hand, it's so much mind-boggling, so much unbelievable the way that the United States is just destroying itself.
Right.
And Russia is, Larry, after all, Russia is a very important player when it comes to Ukraine, Middle East, and Taiwan. I don't know when that reality can hit the decision makers in the United States. Donald Trump talking with Vladimir Putin, talking about Iran, one of the issues, Iran, China, Taiwan, everything. But do you see any sort of future to the reality coming to the mind or somehow hitting the mindset of the people in Washington?
Well, that's the thing that's unfolding before us. So you're living through a time that, when you're my age, looking back, this period we're going through will be seen as the birth of a new economic and political order, one in which the U.S. leadership will have been basically stripped away, and the U.S., through a combination of its own actions, as well as its failure to respond appropriately to external actions, will have frittered away a status as the world's leading economic and military power. It's already no longer the world's leading military power. And its question from an economic standpoint is certainly up in the air. So, and that's where, the United States is having a real difficult time coming to grips with the fact that it's no longer in control of the process.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today.
All right, my friend. Always a pleasure.
We'll see you on Monday. I don't know what time that would be, but we're going to talk.
We'll make it work. See you then.
Yeah. See you.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.